Welcome to the City Full of Noises podcast in association with the Herbert Art Gallery and Museum. My name is Dominic Bubb and I'm here with our normal co-host, Jack Nelson. But today we are very lucky because we have our first special guest in the studio. Welcome to you, Rick. Rick, this is Rick Holt, who is part of the CFON family, but also, as his main job, runs Frequency Central. So what we've wanted to do is bring in a few people, have a conversation with them, learn a little bit about their synth history, learn a little bit about what they do, and then also kind of how they are connected to City Full of Noises. So we're going to get throw you a few questions, Rick.
Yeah, okay. Hi, nice to meet you all again.
Yeah, and we're going to chat a little bit about your history and what you do, and hopefully the people at home will find it interesting.
Hopefully.
So, first question. Tell us a little bit about your history with electronic music. Where did you start? What was your first synth? And what really got you interested in synth music or electronic music?
Well, my first synth was a Wasp, an Electronic Dream Plant Wasp. But electronic music, for me, now that I think about it, started quite a long time before I bought that in 1980. I've got an older brother, and we were both into, scientific stuff, like electronic sets.
Kind of making your own kit type stuff.
Meccano, all of that stuff that we grew up doing. Chemistry sets. But we're also into cassettes.
You know,
it was quite an emerging technology in the 70s, and we had a couple of cassette players.
Yeah.
And we used to mess about with cassettes, recording off the radio. But also recording like shortwave radio and the between the dials and the Russian stations and all the random stuff like that. And we'd be using like the pause button and then later splicing to just do weird stuff with cassettes.
And were you seeing this as it was just a thing to do, or was it you wanted to make a particular type of sound?
I don't think it was ever,
it was just experimentation.
I think it was about the process rather than producing something. It was just enjoying playing with the technology. So we both got into electronics, probably from the electronic sets, and we started buying electronics magazines where it show you how to build your own oscillator. So it would like build some basic bits that I suppose you wouldn't call it a synth, but they did make noise.
Yeah.
So we'd make like oscillators, noise generators, ring modulators, and we'd put stuff through it and make horrible noise. So I think I went to a gig in 1979, which made me want to buy a synthesizer.
Okay.
And there was a guy called Tim Blake. He used to play in Gong, and he was playing with Hawkwind that year.
Right.
And he had a whole range of synths on stage. I think he had a Mini Moog, a couple of Synthias.
Wow.
He had a Roland System 100, which he was using for the sequencer. And I think he had a string machine, maybe, and an organ. And so he played along with Hawkwind, and then he had his own little section in the middle of the set, because the previous summer he'd headlined Glastonbury, and he was kind of doing like a almost like maybe a Jean-Michel Jarre kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
And I was very young at the time, and it just blew my mind that he was just doing all of this sound, this whole thing, sequencing, you know, weird noises, synth parts, all live on stage, nobody else there. So I sold my train set.
Really?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, the next week I sold my train set, and a couple of weeks later, I bought a second-hand Electronic Dream Plant Wasp for 120 quid.
Wow. So for people who don't know the Wasp, can you explain a little bit about what kind of music and what kind of sounds you were able to make with your Wasp?
Well, I've still got a Wasp. It's not the same Wasp that I had back then, because I sold that to buy new gear. But it's a little tiny synth. It was built in Oxford, and I think they built them between 1978 and 1981. It had a touch keyboard, so it wasn't a physical keyboard. And of course, Wasp, it's got a black and yellow theme.
Yeah.
It's quite a good sounding synth even today, despite looking a bit like a toy. But to start off with, for me, I kind of neglected the keyboard altogether. And I used to put a tape splicing block on the keyboard, which would kind of make it sustain a note.
Right, yeah.
And then it had 24 knobs that I could just like manipulate and mangle and make noise with that. In terms of its capabilities, it was quite advanced, really. It had two oscillators. It got a low frequency oscillator. The amplitude envelope could repeat, and the filter envelope could also repeat. So you had three different cyclic elements that made some really interesting polyrhythmic stuff. So I think what I used to do is I used to do some polyrhythmic stuff and record that onto one tape recorder, then play it back, and then do some other stuff on top of it onto another tape recorder.
So almost like a very basic four-track type thing, you kind of recording, overdubbing and overdubbing.
I mean, it's called Sound on Sound, and the more layers you do like that, the more quality that you lose. But it was fun. It was fun for the time. I made my first 24 solo albums like that. Available now in all good record shops.
Yeah, it's all been released during Record Store Day, hasn't it? It's a limited box set.
Yeah, nobody wants to hear any of that, really.
So how did that... So from that, because I know you kind of... You moved on to playing in bands and stuff like that. Where did that kind of... Having that first synth and then kind of moving on to playing, was that an organic thing that all your friends were kind of starting up bands at the same time, or was that you kind of went out to find people to play with?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I was like 15 at the time, going on 16, so I was just about to go to sixth form, and I think I picked up another synth by then. I got a Moog Prodigy, and so I went to sixth form. I was doing electronics at sixth form, and I think every Wednesday afternoon you had what was called elective studies, where you could go and do anything that the college had on offer. And so I thought, well, I'll go to the music department and see what's going on there. And at the start of the session, the lecturer said, well, if you'd all like to introduce yourselves and tell us what instrument you play. And I said, well, I'm Rick and I play the synthesizer. And everybody laughed, and I thought, that's a weird reaction. But at that time, I think it was kind of the Gary Newman period.
Right,
and I think people really weren't quite sure what a synthesizer was. And they might have thought I was joking, I don't know. So out of that, I met a couple of people who became the first band that I was in. I think one of them played bass, one of them played drums. Eventually the drummer dropped out, so we bought a drum machine and we became kind of sub-orchestra manoeuvres.
Nice. You know,
the keyboard player and the bass player and the drum machine and a bit of tape-recorded backing.
Cool. Yeah. Did you sing?
I didn't sing.
No, you've always been the man behind.
Yeah, I mean, I have sung at some points in my musical career, but not very well.
Cool.
Oh, yeah, it's the era of punk. You know, you could get away with it then, couldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't for me, perhaps. Yeah. I wasn't the extra.
I was going to say, so your influences clearly kind of started with almost that kind of the prog movement and the synth use.
Yeah, I mean, that's having an older brother, so that's what's coming from his bedroom. And at the same time, I was picking up the early Human League stuff.
Right, which is actually quite, you know, very different to their later stuff.
Absolutely.
It's not poppy at all. It's very electronic, quite experimental, really.
Early Human League, early Depeche Mode stuff, as well as Joy Division and New Order. That kind of thing.
And that was you kind of finding a voice different to what you
were. Yeah,
I
don't want to go to his gigs anymore.
I want to go
to stuff that I want to go to.
And that was kind of the music you were making
as well. So I think I was in a few new wave bands.
Nice. Did you have the hair?
I did have the hair.
Wow. Yeah. Now, those are if we can get some pictures of you from then on Instagram... Yeah. To put with this podcast, that would be amazing.
What, from my David Sylvian period?
Yeah, anything like that would be great.
No, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure if I'm going to do that.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I understand.
Might do.
It'd be cool.
But I regret it, wouldn't I?
Oh, I don't know. I think people love to see stuff like that and they find it really entertaining. So I think people will think you're very cool. It's all coming back in.
Yeah, no, that's, yeah, I'm sure that's true. So you say you started out with the Wasp, which is a hardwired mono synth.
Yep.
But now you're more associated with modular in terms of Frequency Central. So at what point did you move into modular and what inspired that?
Well, in the mid-90s, I bought a lot of synths. It seemed that a lot of synths were available quite cheap. Mm-hmm. So I picked up a lot of old analog gear. I haven't got it all now. I've got some of it still. And one thing I picked up at that time was a Roland System 100M. Oh, wow. Not sure if you know what that looks like, but it's like a kind of a cabinet modular synth.
That was Roland. Was it their first modular synthesizer they produced?
I think maybe it was the second or the third. I think they did the 100 and then the 700 and then the 100M. So it was kind of like a cabinet that held five modules. And I had two cabinets, but only six modules. So I had essentially like two or three full synthesizer voices, but there was none of the funky stuff in there. I had lots of oscillators, filters, envelopes and BCAs, a couple of LFOs, but none of the stuff that makes it really interesting, like clock dividers and sequencers and the more esoteric stuff. So I had all this space in this second rack. So I thought, well, I'll just build myself some modules. So I built some extra envelope generators. Just cut my teeth on that, because it was quite an easy thing to do. And then I went back over all my electronics magazines from the like 80s and built sequencers and ring modulators, clock dividers.
And so how do you start with that? How did you learn how to build, say, those circuits?
Wow, that's like saying, how did you learn to read, really? I mean, how did you learn to read?
Yeah, too long ago. No, I don't remember.
That's kind of how I feel about it. I'm not sure if I remember when I didn't understand the circuit diagram.
One of those things that you can do now and you can't remember a time when you didn't.
I mean, me and my brother, we were doing this when we were like 10, 11, 12, messing about with electronics and burning our fingers on solder. So it was kind of just, you know, refamiliarizing myself with electronics and maybe learning a little bit more that I didn't know, and just making these schematics into modules.
Wow. See, I mean, that's, as someone who doesn't do that, it's just, I play modules, but I also build them myself, but through other people's designs, including yours, just from DIY kits. I know how to put them together, but I don't know how just this combination of you know, capacitors, resistors, makes how that would produce something like an envelope. That's the thing. Okay. I can't make that leap.
Well, I think one connection you can make between modular and electronics is that electronics is really just a series of connected modules. And if you connect them in the right way, they do this. So it's really just like, it's the same as a modular system, really. It's just you're working on a nanoscale. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, just it kind of, there's so many levels of modular to this. You know,
it's almost as if you've got that weird mix of science and creativity.
Because you go from
the science, which is you have to have these certain elements to make this certain thing. But then the creativity bit is, this makes this certain thing, what, you know, this is what you can do with it. And I think sometimes it's a special kind of brain to kind of go between those two, really. I think most people are one way inclined or another.
And I think, for a lot of people, the stage that they get on at is the creative stage. So as people, you know, like yourself, who it is that, because a circuit, we see modules in terms of, say, a single function, like say it's an envelope generator. That's just a single part of it that forms part of a system. But within that, it's broken down into that modular system within it to make that one function. But I think that's it. I think for most people, that access point is where it becomes something that can just be purely creative, and they can use those creative blocks. But underpinning all of that is this engineering scientific approach, which we kind of need to give that people that kind of lift up to get to that point where it becomes creative and maybe a little bit more tangible, that like you understand a little bit more, okay, this is, let's say, an envelope generator, and this is what it does. And yeah, so I think that's a quite interesting thing. It's what goes on beneath the surface, you know, behind the panel.
I think there are various examples of modules that behind the panel, it's just some basic stuff, but it's the creative way in which they've been put together. Yeah. And it's almost like you've bought somebody's patch and it's like a golden patch.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
And it's a creative way to work.
And I think you can also sometimes tell the modular makers who are either performers or creative people, but also then the modular makers who are primary engineers. Because you get both, don't you?
Yeah, this? You do.
And I think, you know, it's often clear who does what and who, because I think your modules are very clear and very, you know, to a certain extent, there are a couple of esoteric things in there, and, you know, that's great. But I think they're always really easy to follow and understand and how to use and are quite musical in their nature. Whereas I think some modular, it is more sometimes about, you know, how crazy the electronics can get or how crazy you can make a circuit board do certain things. And I think having that balance is really, really important, certainly for kind of, you know, beginners and people who are just stepping onto that kind of modular ladder. Actually, those simple ones are the ones that you'll get the most joy out of because you can immediately make the sounds and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a simple man. I think I know what I don't know with electronics, and I've got quite a broad base, but there's certain aspects that I'm probably not going to touch.
Yeah.
So I go with what I know, and I like one knob per function. I think that's really immediate and tactile and hands-on.
Yeah.
I'm not crazy for menus. I'm not crazy for... I don't personally get a lot of pleasure out of owning modules where I have to have the handbook out to be able to use it.
Yeah.
I think that's really counterintuitive, and that type of thing... saps my creativity, you know.
Sure,
it's kind of a wall between you and your creativity.
No, I totally agree. So the way,
for me at least,
I think that actually, you know, the more I've kind of got into modular is although I do have some menu driven modules, I do find actually the modules I might step to first are the ones that I don't have to remember certain things to do certain things, because you can just immediately start getting your sounds out of them. I think there's a lot of people out there that agree with you as well. I think they like the simplicity of that one thing per knob or one thing per button or whatever that is. How did you go from, obviously it's a big step to kind of be making a few modules yourself for your own enjoyment or for whatever you wanted to use, to then think, actually, you know what, I could do this as a business. So what was, or I can do this as something I can, you know, make money from. What was that kind of, where what was that thought process? How did you, or was it something you fell into, or were you very determined, I want to see if I can make this into a business?
I don't think it was ever a thought process.
Okay.
I think it was just something that happened.
Okay.
I got divorced maybe 20 years ago, and the 100M went, because, you know, money.
Yeah.
And that was okay. Didn't mind that. I had other synths, but that made sense to get rid of because it was worth quite a lot of money. So I had no modular at that time.
Yeah.
But I found myself making pedals, you know, for fun. Mm-hmm. And I was on some forums, and pedal forums.
Yeah, yeah.
And a couple of people said, "Hey, will you sell me one of those?" So I started to sell pedals and very small amplifiers made out of vacuum tubes.
Right.
Kind of did that for 2 or 3 years. And I do bespoke pedals as well. So you might say, "Hey, I'm a guitarist and I want a pedal that goes, ah!" And I'd say, "Oh yeah, I can do that." So I designed a pedal that went, "Ah!" And you'd give me some money for that. Yeah. So I did that for a few years, and it was really just like a jobby, really. It was never...
So were you still working in another job when you were doing that?
Yeah, I was working in education.
Right.
And it was never something that I could see as a as a career.
Yeah.
It was just like a bit of
a hobby, really.
Yeah. But I kind of got the hankering to have some modular again in my life. So I emailed a guy called Tom Bugs, who you may have heard of from Bug Brand.
Yeah.
And I think I'd made some interactions with him because I'd modified some pedals to interface with his Bug Brand systems. So I said, hey, Tom, really don't know what the modular market is. Which format should I get into? And he said, Eurorack. So I thought, oh, what's this Eurorack? So, oh, okay. So I think it was probably, December 2011. I ordered from Farnell kind of a blank 19-inch rack that you could fit some panels in, and I ordered some blank panels, which were made by Schroff. So it's just like, you know, 10 HP panels, right, I guess, and some 4 HP panels. No, 6 HP. And I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll make some of my own modules. Because at that time, I was making my own circuit boards, you know, acid etching, and I thought, I'll just make some modules. So that Christmas, I made my first Eurorack module, which was a System 100M, of course.
Yeah.
Envelope generator.
So how did you... Because Eurorack is very different to the 100M size, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
How did you go from shrinking the circuit boards of the 100M down to Eurorack size? Was that an easy thing for you to do? Was that quite simple?
Yeah, I mean, I've always enjoyed doing circuit board layouts.
Yeah.
And so it was just a process, you know. Okay. It just has to fit behind that panel, so it has to be a bit deeper than So I did that, designed that. People said, oh, can we buy that? And so all of a sudden I'm making System 100X, what did I call it, System X envelope generators. Then I started with the filter, cloned the filter, and then the oscillators and envelope generators, because really I just wanted to make another 100M for myself, which I did. But along the way, all of a sudden, I think the first distributor I sold to was in Australia, Equinox Oz. They're not around anymore, but they contacted me and said, hey, do you want to sell some modules? And I thought, oh, this is a new idea, selling modules to a shop. I wonder how that works. So they kind of handheld me through that.
Yeah.
And then about a year to the day later that I bought that rack from Farnell to make my own system, a guy called Sean Cleary, who runs Analog Haven, contacted me and said, oh, we'd like to stock some of your modules. And I said, yeah, that sounds great. What would you like? And he said, well, we'll have 20 of each. And at that time, I had 6 modules. So I was thinking, wow, that's 120 modules. How am I going to make them? Because everything was by hand at that stage. I was making the panels by hand. I was making the PCBs by hand, putting them all together by hand. So I had a contact that I know make my first set of fabbed boards, and made it much easier to build.
Yeah.
And the amount of money that Sean Cleary sent me was kind of like a business loan.
Right, right, yeah.
And it enabled me to spend money on the business.
Yeah.
And it became, oh, I better get an accountant now. And all of a sudden, I was, by accident, a Eurorack manufacturer.
So how long after that audit were you able to kind of quit what you were doing and go full-time into Frequency Central?
I think I did probably 5 years when I dropped a day in my day job, dropped down to 4 days, then I dropped down to 2.5 days, and then I just gave it up and just did Frequency Central full time.
So it was quite a long process, really. Yeah, it wasn't an overnight thing, or, you know, it wasn't even... Because, I mean, one of the questions I had was, what was the thinking behind Frequency Central? But it sounds like it almost kind of...
There never was any.
Yeah, it just kind of like... It came from a pure love of having modular, I'm guessing.
It just happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
If somebody said to me, oh, I'll pay you to wash your car, my car, I'd think, oh... Okay, go and do that. All of a sudden, they're washing everybody's car. It's kind of like that, really.
Yeah. And the fact that you, I suppose, were already quite, you know, knowledgeable about that 100M system, the fact that choosing to clone those kind of modules allowed you...
I'd already built them already.
So you kind of knew what you were doing, and it was quite an easy process to... So what was the first original kind of frequency module, frequency central module? What was the first one that was actually, that's my idea?
So through the guitar pedal world, I met a guy called Tom Wiltshire, who's also known as Electric Druid, and he was making these digital LFOs, VCLFO2, I think it was called, or something like that. And I said, hey, can I borrow your design? I'll buy the PIC chips off you, that's the programmable chips, and I'll design a Eurorack LFO around it. So that became something that I've always done, is I've had digital modules in the Frequency Central stable. And I did a couple of collaborations with Tom Wiltshire, which resulted in Wave Rider, which became Klangstat, which is the digital oscillator.
Yeah.
And a couple of other things I did with them over the years, which I don't think we sell anymore. But that kind of broke my teeth on working with software designers too.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And obviously you've kind of, you've now even worked with your son on the module, haven't you?
So by sheer coincidence, well, it actually probably wasn't. I've always encouraged my son to use computers, and he's a computer scientist now. So when he was doing his electronics A-level, he said to me, Dad, I need to do a project with a number of submodules. So I said, well, I've got this module that I've been working on, but I've realised that to make it with analogue electronics, it's just going to be too big. There's just going to be too much stuff there. So I've shelved it for that reason. So if you want to do that, I can give you the design spec for it. And you can do that.
And that module was?
It's Bartos Fleur. So Jet designed Bartos Fleur. I'd done an analog version of it the year before, but it just got too unwieldy. And because I'd worked with Tom Wiltshire, I knew what you could do with code. And I knew a lot of that electronics could just be done with a very small amount of code. So while all his colleagues on his electronics course were making clocks, he was designing Bartos Fleur Eurorack module.
Look at that. You can't ask for better than that, can you, really?
So he got a pass.
I should hope so.
And so he then went to university, and every summer he'd come home and we'd design a module together.
That's brilliant. Yeah. Real family affair.
I'll tell you what, family together.
It's a really nice thing to do because you know, there's such a lot of a bonding that you can do. But we argued quite a lot as well. I think Jet had seen a piece of equipment in my studio. I think it's a Roland drum machine, a DR110 Boss drum machine.
Great.
And he had an idea in his head of how it worked, and he thought he'd do a little bit of code to kind of emulate.
It was one of the first computer controlled drum machines, isn't it, that people could get?
So off his own bat, he kind of did a little bit of code, and I think I'd gone on holiday, and he kind of hooked up a prototype. He lashed up a prototype, and it had 8 LEDs on it. And the LEDs were to tell you in binary where you were in the sequence. And he was kind of explaining to me, he was really excited about it when I came back. And I said, well, so tell me about these LEDs again. And he said, well, that tells you in binary where you are. And I said, well, I don't understand binary. And he said, well, everybody understands binary, Dad. And I said, yeah, not everybody understands binary.
Yeah, I can confirm I'm one of those people that doesn't understand binary.
I just know it's got a 0 and it's got a 1.
As do I. So so what we did with that idea is that we added a 2-segment LED display instead, which took up part of the processor's abilities. So we slimmed it down from 8 to 4 channels, and that became Polygraph.
Okay. You see all these modules that I've heard of, but I just was unaware that they were collaboration or family collaborations. Yeah.
That's great. And I think on the back of that it might say, not everybody understands binary jet or something like that.
I do always love those little messages that people put on the back. Leading on to that then, what would you say is your favourite or most proud kind of, what you're most proud of module from the Frequent Century? Because you've got about 30 or 40 modules now, haven't you?
Yeah.
Oh, what's the one that you think, I'm really like that, or that does something different, or I'm really proud of what I did on that.
Oh, could I have a top three?
Top three is like fine. Yeah.
Okay, so I think I'll always have a soft spot for the System X envelope generator, really, because there are so many out there, like by an order of magnitude more than any other module.
Yeah, I mean that was my first Frequency Central module.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's no surprise. Without that module, probably Frequency Central wouldn't be doing modular now. Yeah. So for that reason, I'd say System X Envelope Generator. Number two would probably be Monograph, which is the 20 HP standalone voice module. Really just because it's so compact and sounds so good.
Mm. Yeah.
Really. I've got four of them in a rack, and it's like a polyphonic monograph, and I can just lose days with that. And number three is the last module that I've created.
Oh wow! Yeah. Is this one that's been released or recently released?
No, it will always be the last module.
Oh, I see what you mean. Just
because you're always really excited about its recent work, aren't you?
Yeah.
Well, we'll come on to future modules in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But as a kind of follow-up to that question-ish. So a lot of what CFON is and a lot of what we like to do is to introduce people to modular and how to use modular and, finding ways to kind of allow people to play with this kind of stuff. And we've obviously done a little bit of that with the workshops we've done, but if we stay with kind of Frequency Central and your modules, if someone wanted to build a Frequency Central centered rack to create, either a monosynth or something a little bit esoteric, what would be the modules that you would recommend for people to get to create what you would class as a kind of archetypal Frequency Central thing?
Well, that's kind of easy because there's actually something on the website called Starter Bundle.
Right, okay.
Oh, great.
And what that is, it's an easy-to-build oscillator, an easy-to-build filter, an easy-to-build envelope generator, an easy-to-build VCA. It's the CMOS, and then the white face filter, Senvelope, and the More VCAs module. All really easy to build, relatively. And they all sound good. And when you've built the four of them, you've got a complete synth voice.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think that's the thing. Like with modular, I think you can start very small, and let's say you four modules, that can be. And I think as well, I mean, the thing that I found with modular is the fact that what might sound like a small system or quite a basic synthesizer, if it was in a keyboard hardwired version, you can just get so much more out of it because you have so much more flexibility in terms of those routings. But that's it. You can have people have enormous systems, was it from Depeche Mode, Martin Gore?
He's got every module.
Yeah, he does.
In the world ever.
It looks like wallpaper in a studio. It's the whole thing is covered.
I think, in fact, that is, from what I gather, that's just storage, isn't it? And then he takes stuff out to put into and create systems from that. I don't think it's completely patchable, from what I gather.
Well, I mean, that's you need like 3 meter long patch cables if you want to get from one end to the other.
And the amount of power as well. You imagine
exactly.
But that's how I like to work with modular. Is I like small systems, and I like just put a system together and play with that. And I think what that comes from is doing video demos, where I've always tended to put a small system together and like wring as much creativity and colour as you can out of that small 48 HP system.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that we've talked about, the fact that I mean, having those, partly it's, you get to, every time you rearrange a synthesizer, you re-rack something, you're building a new synthesizer, you know, you've got a new idea, something you're trying to achieve with it, and it's a new instrument every time. So that's one thing that's really fun. But then also I think when you have, again, with modular, when one of the strengths is the flexibility. Say if I find that if I have a big system, you use everything for its primary purpose, and it's a little bit less interesting. You go, okay, well, I need this function. I'll go to the thing that primarily does
that. That's exactly right. Yeah.
And that's it. When you have, like, okay, you've only got one module left, and it's like, okay, well, how can I use this creatively to fill in those gaps? So I just find it's a much more creatively satisfying experience when you have those limitations that you put on yourself, and you have to think your way out of them.
Yeah. That's exactly the point that I've found when I've put a small system together for a video. It's like, oh no, if only I could add another module, I could do this. You can't. So you think, oh, okay, I could do this instead. And it's not quite what I wanted, but it's something different.
It takes you on an avenue that, you know, otherwise you end up repeating yourself. You know, you end up discovering new different ways of doing the same thing, essentially. Yeah. Do you have any new designs that you're due to be releasing in the future?
Well, it's funny you should ask me that, Jack.
Okay.
It's almost as if we planned it.
It's almost as if we planned this whole interview.
Yeah.
It's all scripted. I'm always kind of working at least half a dozen modules behind.
Oh, wow.
So maybe at the moment I've got maybe 10 modules.
10 modules.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, some are simple, some are not so simple.
And you, what I always find with you, Rick, is you always kind of show a little bit off.
Yeah.
So I see, and I know other people, we've seen stuff that you're going to release a good year and a half ago now, maybe a year ago, possibly even two on some
even
stuff.
Even three.
So
the next module that I'm just getting ready to release is Strips, which is a four into two stereo mixer, expandable to 8 into 2 if you buy two of them. It's essentially it's a VCA mixer, so it's got silent mutes. They don't interrupt the signal path, they mute the VCA. You've got voltage control of volume. It's got send and return loop, which can either be normally inverted, because not every effects module is going to be non-inverting, so it has that ability too. It's got headphone out, no, it hasn't got headphone output, it's got 6.3mm line level outputs as well as Eurorack level outputs.
That sounds really interesting. You say chainable, so you can...
Chainable.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, again, when it comes to designing your own system, it's that kind of thing where, you know, you rather than have to buy that mixer, which has, say, a set number of channels, you can just keep adding to it or taking it away depending on the needs of your system.
So when I was designing it, I thought, well, actually, this would be quite easy to chain two together and have 8 into 2. So I introduced that ability and I thought, well, I could make it so it's infinitely chainable, but who's going to buy four of the same, you know? There's almost no point
in. We'll find out. I mean, you've got a system with four monographs, so
I have
people
I
do
have,
it.
But nobody else has, as far as I know. But as I've been finishing it off, it's made me think, I've built this mixer, but what I should have done is I should have designed a modular mixer, right? So you have, like, you know, on a mixer you have the output section. Maybe there should be a generic output section, and then you just, like, plug in as many different channels as you want.
Yeah.
So
it's almost as well, because you've just released as a kind of mass product, product version, which is the Silent Disco, which was a module you made for City Full of Noises.
That was a City is Full of Noises module. Yeah.
So, I mean, is there a way you could bring Silent Disco and Strips together and have that as that kind of, you know, almost that modular style, so you could almost have, not that they would work, could you redesign them so they could work together and give you that kind of...
You've just picked my brains there, because as I was buttoning up this module, Strips, and doing the last revision, I got my notebook out and I drew a few sketches of what could be like a completely modular mixer. So you could buy like two channels or four channels and plug these into the output bit, which would have like your master volume
on, yeah, yeah,
and your sending returns and headphone output.
You could have stereo, you could have mono channel. Yeah, that would be really good.
So that's something that I'll maybe work on. But Strips has taken 3 years from the first version to the last one, and I haven't been working on it for 3 years.
I was going to ask about that. Say there's those modules that maybe take, you know, up to 3 years to actually get to the point where they're released. I mean, what is it that prevents you releasing them? Is it about just like scheduling it, or is it about like tweaking the module?
It's a variation. It's a very number of things. With Strips, I built it around these sliders, these slider potentiometers, which became no longer available.
Yeah.
So I kind of just sat on it for a while, and that was during COVID, and stuff was becoming unavailable then, and I sort of sat on it to see if they came back, but they didn't.
Yeah.
So a year later I redesigned it for a different slider and made a few tweaks to it, and there was a couple of things I wasn't happy about, and with that I tend to just think, well, I'll just put it over there and I'll just process in the background and come back to it and look at it again, and sometimes the problem solves itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something I've talked about, it not just necessarily in music or just as part of the creative process. Sometimes you just need time for
an idea.
Yeah, that's it. Let it kind of just sort of tumble around in your brain, in the background. And then when you come back to it, sometimes a solution that wasn't very apparent before just becomes immediately
obvious.
Absolutely,
yeah. And the other thing is, the bigger the project, the more you have to put into it, and it's easier to finish the smaller projects.
Yeah.
It's just easier.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier to take the low-hanging fruit, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think you say about the shortage, you know, I think that seems to be a problem which is across modular and, you know, synthesizer production in general. Mm-hmm. There's been like chip crisis, you know, I think it's, I mean, I'm not sure how much is related to COVID, but since then it has, been, I think, a problem for a lot of manufacturers, and a lot of modules have been, say, discontinued at this point, just because it's just become impossible to get hold of the components now.
Yeah, I mean, I think with that, you just have to maybe think creatively about it. But I mean, there's modules that I'm stocking now that at the start of COVID I just bought loads of chips and to kind of future-proof them.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of okay for that right now.
Forward thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, you never know what's around the corner.
Well, that's true. Well, and something very much was around the corner, wasn't it? So, yeah.
So all you people looking for LM137-00s, I've got them all.
Is that where they've all gone?
Yes, I've got them
all in Coventry.
You shouldn't announce that. You'll have the modular companies trying to grab them off.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Leading on to, so mention Seat Full of Noises and you creating a module for it. We've, in an earlier podcast, we talked a little bit about Seat Full of Noises and kind of discussed its origin story, really. It'd be lovely to hear kind of it from your side, because obviously I can talk about it from where we were in the Herb and our ideas behind it. But what would be interesting is kind of what you thought when you got, because it was an email from me, I think.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And what you kind of thought about it when you got it, and then kind of what you're thinking of it is, and you know, and your involvement in it.
Okay, so. Really, I've always kind of just done what I do with Frequency Central, and I've put it out there, and if people want to access that, that's fine. But I've never really been part of like the modular scene, you know, going to the modular meets, and I've never been massive on promotion, really. I just do what I do, and I've got a life aside from that I continue with. So I got this email from Dominic saying, would you like to be part of some sort of modular event at the Herbert Gallery in Coventry, which is my city? And, well, you have to do that, don't you, if it's your city. And a friend of mine said to me a few years ago, well, you know, you are Coventry's only modular synth manufacturer. And I never really thought of myself as that. I just thought, well, I'm just a guy who solders, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he said, you're Coventry's only modular synth manufacturer. And it kind of, oh, maybe I am, yeah. So first of all, I was very flattered to be asked to do something like that. And when I found it was geared towards an introduction to newbies, to modular, I thought that was hugely exciting. And the opportunity to pay homage to Delia Derbyshire and her part in electronic music, I thought that was really a value too.
So you were involved in City Full of Noises. You ran our first City Full of Noises workshop, which was the introduction to modular workshop. Is there, what from kind of the last two events, what were kind of been your favourite bits, your highlights?
Do you know what I found this year is because I was running my workshops, I missed out on some aspects of City Full of Noises. So I've got a different outlook on it compared to people who experienced a drone bath, for example. But my favourite part has really been having dozens and dozens of like-minded people in the same space, excited about the same things. Yeah. And that's something that you might get with other interests, but I think it's quite rare to get with modular. So that's great.
Yeah, no, I think it is something which, it is niche. I think, to me, it's I know, a coincidence, the fact that modular's kind of had this rebirth, kind of in parallel with, say, the growth of like the internet, essentially. You know, I think the more online people have got, there's been more opportunities to connect with other people who have a similar hobby. And I do think it's something which it's nice to actually get those people in that same place and find those other people that share that interest. I think it's I don't know. I definitely think it's one of the strengths of the festival.
And, you know, I've met many people through Cities Full of Noises, some of whom have become friends, and that's great. And some of whom have become collaborators, and that's great as well. It just expands your creative horizons, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I think, say, you know, for me, it's this quite strange journey from, say, 7 years ago when I bought my first module to being to the point where, you know, I'd have Frequency Central modules. In fact, you know, I didn't even realise you were in Coventry for a good few years, and someone pointed it out. I had just no idea that someone actually make it on the doorstep. I was just aware of the company and it had the modules. And then gone from that point of it being this thing that I was doing on my own. I didn't know anyone else who did it. I was just interested in it. And then I've just met more and more people. And also, you know, I'd see people like Gaz Williams. I'd watch his videos and Ben, the Div Kid. And now it's just become a thing where I've gone from it being just purely my bedroom to something where now I'm that bit more actually involved in the community and working with you and working with these people that I've known about, either their work or, you know, seeing that them as online personalities. Suddenly it has become this thing where everyone has come together and it has become a lot more close-knit. Certainly from my perspective.
Well, I think that's the great thing about the modular community. It is quite an open community. It is different to your hardcore synth nerds There is an openness to it. I think there's an acceptance to it as well. And I think there's a freedom to it, which you don't see with other communities.
I think what that is down to is that if the three of us brought in our systems, you showed me your system, I probably wouldn't know how to work it. and vice versa. And that's the openness in modular, is that all these instruments have been built by the people using them, and they're individual and they're unique. It's kind of folky.
Exactly. This is the conversation we had.
We're building our own instruments.
Well, no, exactly. And this is, the whole idea to me, that it runs that parallel to folk in the way that, you know, say in the 60s, it was something which, you know, folk was never designed to be something which, or at least people didn't see it as a, you know, a route to fame. It was just something where people would share peer-to-peer. And it was, you know, and I think that's a lot, you know, that's the way modular operates now.
But interestingly, because I read a great book, I can't remember what it's called now.
what's it called? Electric Britain or Electric Britannica, which follows the course of folk in Britain. And interestingly, you can kind of see URAC following it, because you kind of, at the moment, you start to see all these big producers have these racks of URAC. I recently, in fact, today saw there was a post on somewhere, it might have been Reddit or something like that, about Drake posting on Instagram somebody's URAC, and like it was a massive rack, saying, you know, I've just spent 2 or 3 hours with this amazing music. And, you know, that is kind of what happened with folk when you started having these supergroups like Pentangle, and where they brought in electronic rock music into folk. And it feels like it's kind of on that same kind of trajectory. Obviously, that didn't end so well for folk. But I feel like actually URAC and Modular has a little bit, is a little bit maybe more grounded in that way, in the sense I think it is, because the quality of music is much wider now than it ever was in the 60s or 70s, that, you know, we can have massive big producers like, you know, Deadmau5 and people like that. And I think J.J. Abrams has got his own
He's a very
And I think we can survive those people making it a star thing, but also having a homebrew stuff as well. And I think that is down to the openness of the community.
I think there's also this like no expectations things in terms of gear. Like with guitarists, it's like, it's what guitar you've got and it's what amp you've got. And it's not like that in Modular, because it's so diverse. There are modules of the moment, and they go from year to year. But people kind of tend to find their little niche of a kind of system that I like working with, and they go down that rabbit hole.
I think that's, there's something which gives me this kind of degree of pleasure to know that statistically, I can say with a degree of certainty that my, there's no other system exactly like mine that exists in the world. You know, the fact that people have the exact same combination of modules, and even if they did, they probably make completely different music with it anyway. It is just purely down to the individual. It's not, it's you know, it's very unmass produced. I think that's something which, that's something I really like about it.
I think it's that unique algorithm, isn't it, of the a module can drive your creativity, but it would drive yours in a different way to how it would drive mine or Dominic's. And then if you put 20 of those in the same case, we're all going to be doing different stuff, even if we had the same.
Exactly. I remember hearing a story about, I think, maybe at Live Aid or something like that, where Mark Knopfler was playing on David Gilmour's system, and it sounded like Mark Knopfler. And that's it. It doesn't matter whose guitar you play. It's who's playing it that makes a difference. And they'd have a different approach in terms of when they're designing their own system, but they still sound like them. And I think it's the same with URAC. You know, it's, you can have a completely different system. It might be designed for a specific purpose, but someone else would use it entirely different way.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Rick. Thank you for coming and telling us your story. Hopefully, in future podcasts, we'll be able to bring you back and bring on a few other guests, and we'll come up with some other kind of conversations and ideas that we can have a chat about. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dominic. Thank you, Jack.
Thanks.